Hey, I want to take just a second to let you know how important you are to us. In fact, we couldn't even do this without your prayer support, without your financial support. We need you.
You are our partners, family life, and our ministry does not exist without donors and listeners who say, I don't want to just be a spectator. I want to play. And I want to be a partner with Family Life prayerfully. That means you're praying for us. But I tell you what, I don't know if you understand this. We need your financial support as well. This is a listener-supported ministry. And we actually have a goal right now in the month of August to raise $250,000, which is a lot of money.
I know. It sounds like a lot, doesn't it? But we want you to partner with us to make a difference in marriages and families with the gospel.
So let's jump in together and make a mark. You can do that. Just go to familylifetoday.com and make a donation there. And because you're making a mark, we're going to give you a pen that makes a mark on paper. You get the connection. And it's a Family Life limited edition pen. So if you give a donation today or tomorrow or anytime, you become our partner and we can change the world together.
A lot of the traits that are now in me because of my childhood are traits that I value. Like, the hustle mentality, the ability to work really hard, just the ability to kind of withstand pain, and discomfort, being comfortable, being uncomfortable. Like, these are all things that kind of came to me because of a typical childhood. One of the biggest challenges for someone in my position is to say, how do I make my son strong without inflicting a childhood that requires strength?
Welcome to Family Life Today, where we want to help you pursue the relationships that matter most. I'm Shelby Abbott, and your hosts are Dave and Ann Wilson. You can find us at familylifetoday.com or on the Family Life app.
This is Family Life Today. We've got one of the most interesting authors.
He's like the most interesting person on the planet, right?
He's got a really cool hat on, too.
And he just has a great
I want to hear you say his name.
Daniel, let me see. I have to look at it.
There it is.
Daniel Nayer.
I never get names right. That was a pretty good one to
that
Daniel.
That was a good one. The last one was great.
You got to say it the way you say it, though.
Nayeri.
Yeah, we can't do that. That's impossible. But your book, Everything Sad is Untrue, a true story, has been the sort of center of what we've been talking about the last 2 days. I really didn't think we'd do a day three. Because you said so much in the last 2 days. I'm like, where else can we go? But here's what I want to ask, as a dad now, coming from the home and the experience that you've had in your life, how do you approach being a dad? How do you embody that position?
Boy, that's a tough question. When my son was about to be born, I was really, really anxious. I can't say I had any really great father figures, except for late in high school, my football coach was sort of the person I think of as a great father figure in my life.
Offensive guard, linebacker?
I was outside linebacker.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right.
Not at the level you're used to.
I don't know. You played in Oklahoma. That's some pretty good football.
High school, yeah. I felt like barbaric. I didn't really have a sense of how to do it. And I had a friend who I was kind of just mentioning it to, and he goes, well, yeah, I know you didn't have a lot of good dads in your life, but you want to be a good dad, right? And I said, well, yeah, that's what I've been telling you this whole time. I want to be a good dad. And he goes, well, guess what? Most of the people who weren't good dads didn't want to be.
They didn't even care about it.
Right. And I was like, and it was a light bulb. I was like, oh.
That is a light bulb.
You're right. Yeah. They didn't even want to be. Mm. And he's like, so just want to be a good dad as much as possible. That was the beginning. That wasn't all of it. Of course, you have to actually work on it. And I think the other is question that always pops up in my head is, a lot of the traits that are now in me because of my childhood are traits that I value. Like, the hustle mentality, the ability to work really hard, just the ability to kind of withstand pain, and discomfort, being comfortable, being uncomfortable. Like, these are all things that kind of came to me because of a typical childhood. One of the biggest challenges for someone in my position is to say, how do I make my son strong without inflicting a childhood that requires strength?
Yeah.
Like, I don't want him to have that. I certainly wouldn't just send him through the same meat grinder and tell him, come out on the other side. But I'm not actually, that's a question I think about all the time. Mm. He's never going to experience poverty on that level. Mm. And, you know, he's always going to have a dad who, like, will care for him and stuff like that. So I think trying to figure that out has been the challenge of my fatherhood. I tell him I love him probably too much, too many times a day. Like, I'm like, if my son's around, my arms are wrapped around his neck. Like, that's something that I'm trying to still figure out. Because mm-hmm. there are times where I remember a kind of reaction that I would want from him. I see him in sports now, you know, he does wrestling or something like that. Like, there's a killer instinct, and then there's like being soft or whatever. And these metaphors that we'll throw around, and trying to figure out how to build that up without being somebody who's aggressive or punching down, or just trying to figure out what exactly, how do I give him those kind of skills? I think that's probably every father thinks that way, right? Is how do I give him the best part of my childhood without the worst part?
Yeah.
I mean, working with NFL athletes, they had that as well. Because a lot of them came up tough times.
Yeah.
Grind. Mm-hmm. And now they're wealthy and they're raising kids in wealth. And they're like, I don't want to raise them as spoiled.
That's right.
You know, entitled kids. So there's that balance of allowing hardship to shape their character.
Yeah.
You know, here's my next question. So you didn't see a great model from your dad as a husband. You're now a husband. How do you approach that?
That's a great question. Well, so we dated for 9 years before, and a lot of it was for that. A lot of it was like spending a lot of time. Like, I met my wife when we were 18 in college and undergrad. And
9 years?
Yeah, we dated for a long time. Maybe it was 8. For those 8 years, it was, you know, I knew I would like to marry this person, but had none of the toolkit.
Were you afraid of marriage or no?
No, I wanted to be married, but also, like, an example would be conflict resolution, right? A common problem in marriage. And my conflict resolution, I described it as, I remember one time we were in an argument and she was just like, well, let's take a second and think about it and we'll just come back to this. And I was like, what? Like, put a pause? Are you? No. We have to, like,
Daniel, this is me and this is Dave. Like, let's just separate, like, No,
absolutely not. And just kind of not understanding that, you know, take 10 minutes. A lot of this is because you need a Snickers bar. So, like, calm down. And that wouldn't have occurred to me, right? I was kind of like, let's get in the ring. Let's, like, duke it out, metaphorically, of course. Like, let's duke it out. Like, just, like, have the argument. Say everything that comes into our heads. And then forgive each other afterwards. It's like, hey, no, you don't, you know, have some control over your mouth.
See, this was me. This is why I had to write this book that I'm writing.
Exactly.
And one phrase that pops into my head a lot, I punish people with fire and she punishes people with ice. So she would be hurt in an argument and it would feel icy.
She
and
would I would become cold. And I would be back. Like,
what? And when I punish someone, I punish with fire. And first of all, you shouldn't be finding ways to punish your spouse in any way. Like, it's not your job. But two, like, why are you harming the thing that is a part of you? Like, why are you trying to do that? These were things I heuristically didn't understand until, years that we dated. I remember we tried to, you know, we were thinking, we wanted to get married. So we went to our church and said, you know, we'd like to do, like, premarital counseling. And they're like, oh, cool. Are you engaged? And we're like, no, we're not engaged. We're just dating. And the guy's like, well, this is usually for people who are engaged. We're like, we understand. But this is like a pre-premarital counseling. Why don't we just do that? And, like, we just wanted to give us the questions. Like, hit us with the questions.
Help us find out if we want to get engaged.
Yeah. And but it was a funny little moment. I didn't realize that was, I guess it was seen as abnormal. There's an old story of me as a sixth grade where I wanted to go to the young married couples class in our church. Because at this point, there were so many divorces in my childhood. And so I was like terrified that the divorce was just going to be a thing for me. Mm. So I'm 12 and I show up to this young
married couple. You really went?
Yeah, yeah.
And
they were going through a program. Yeah, they were doing this like workbook program. And I was like sitting there like this little kid. Now I look back and I'm like, what must they have thought? And the pastor was like, okay, well, so there's a lot of conversation here that's really not for you. Yeah. We're not going to have you sit in on the, like, you know, it was a workbook. So on the chapters that are about intimacy and things like that, you know, we don't need you for those weeks. But if you'd like to be here for the first week and it's a couple weeks in, then great. And so I sat in and watched the little videos where they talked about.
I'm telling you, that's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Because it shows the heart of kids, like they want more than maybe what their parents had.
Yeah.
And you're willing to learn it at 12 years old.
Yeah, that was probably too early. Yeah, but I mean, it was a lot of...
It shows your heart, though.
Yeah.
Well, some of our listeners are going to be, you never explain the title.
Right.
I mentioned it day one.
I love it.
Everything sad is untrue. I know where it comes from, but help our listeners.
Sure. Yeah. A lot of people, I mean, I'm aware that it's technically an inaccurate statement right now. There are sad things in this world, and that is true. But it comes from a couple of places. The specific phrase comes from Lord of the Rings. There's this part at the end where the heart of the story is this little hobbit named Samwise Gamgee, and he's just delightful and naive and heroic and loyal and kind. And this horrible no spoilers for Lord of the Rings, so I gotta give this to you.
Are you a Lord of the Rings guy?
I do. I grew up loving it. Yeah, I still love it. And so there's a moment where Samwise kind of discovers that this thing that was very tragic that they thought had happened did not happen. And so he runs up and he asks that question and just this childlike naivete that I adore. And he says, well, is everything sad going to become untrue? And the answer is, of course, like, yes, in the future tense, everything sad will become untrue. Mm. And that used to be the first title of this book, Everything Sad Will Become Untrue. Mm. And then I started to think about it from the perspective of not Samwise, who's delightful and naive, but from the perspective of this young boy, myself, this narrator of this book, who's kind of in a particularly dark place, but looking past into the future, and how we know that our experience and our expectation of the future will absolutely change our experience of the present. Mm. And so he sort of starts to claim... I thought that my character would probably claim that future tense into the present tense.
Yeah.
He'd say everything sad is untrue. I have been called onto the carpet by a lot of theologians to defend that position. And were I to do that, I would begin with some legalese. I would say, let's define all our terms. Everything can stay everything. We'll keep everything everything. Sad is just sad. I'll keep it the highest standard. It doesn't even have to be everything tragic is untrue. We'll keep it as everything mildly sad. Untrue, I'm not going to be one of these slippery people who tries to redefine truth. We'll keep it capital T, truth. So now we just have to redefine is. And in this case, of course, if you want to be practical about it, is could be everything sad is at this moment untrue. Okay, that's not accurate. But let's redefine it as everything sad may as well be untrue. This is still grammatically works, and I like it. Now I think I'll stand by that statement. Everything sad may as well be untrue, given the timeline we're on.
Yeah.
Given that on a long enough timeline, we're all dead, and on the other side of it, and looking back, and there's so much more.
I'm curious, would you just talk to the listener who is in the middle of that struggle, in the middle of pain, and in the middle of that waiting period?
Yeah.
You know, because you guys have lived that. Your mom has especially felt it because she's also providing for you guys as two little kids. How would you encourage them?
Goodness. Well, as you know, so you alluded to it that I, you know, from 18 to now, I've sort of been a fanboy of Tim Keller. And I think he's, so he has a wonderful sort of illustration that I think always applies to this moment, which is about that idea, right? That our expectation of the future changes our present, no matter what kind of present we have. the way he describes it is, what if I gave you a job and it was, you were in a dark room putting, you know, a widget into a widget, and all, you did that all day, every day, right? And but I told you that at the end of the year, I'm going to give you an $50 billion, and but you're going to do this for a whole year, and of course you, David, I'm at the end of the, your year, you're going to do the exact same job. I'm going to give you $50,000, and I'm telling you, your years are going to be the exact same activity, but a completely different experience. Mm. Why? And this is scribbled right out of a great Keller sermon, and the reason, of course, is that you're going to spend your year spending that $50 billion. Yeah. And you're going to go, what kind of boat should I have? And those days are going to go so fast, and you're going to think about all the different, you know, glorious experience you're going to have on the other end.
Things she would buy for our grandkids. That's right. What she probably would do.
And you're going to spend the time thinking about how $50,000 after taxes on an hourly.
Can't live on it.
And, you know, it's still, you know, it's okay. And then what am I going to do with the after that? What's going to be my job the next year? And you're going to still be worried, because even though, of course, that's a lot of money in the global sense of the word, right, your year is going to be very different. And of course, there could be a person right next to you who's going to get $50, and they're going to have just a absolute drudgery of a time, right? Mm. And that's really meaningful. That it's you know, it sounds like a little kind of I don't know, just an aphorism, but the reality is that I've been in those situations where I have a year where I have something to look forward to, or I have something, and it absolutely changes my present. And I think that was what my mother did in that refugee camp, right?
Yeah.
We were expecting to go to school, and so we needed to know English so that we could have friends. Like, my friends were waiting for me.
She's always looking ahead.
Yeah, but I just needed to know how to talk to them, you know, and my I had to keep my grades up because I had a future. And I think those were very different experiences than saying, let's just, you know, muddle here and wait. And
because then hopelessness sinks in.
Absolutely.
That there is no future.
Right.
And you're saying, like, you're always looking forward to that. And Keller talked about that in a sermon.
In many sermons. Yeah, he nailed it on that topic.
Yeah, it might be one of the most important things ever.
Mm-hmm.
Hope.
Yeah.
Think about it. You can wake up with even a sliver of hope. You can get through the present because you're dreaming of the future. But if you don't have hope.
Yeah. I mean, the short answer to your question is, yeah, I would just send them to Keller's Sermon on Suffering. Why would I say it?
He said it really well.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, no, it was wonderful. He had a lot to say on suffering, I think, and that was very helpful.
Speaking of Tim Keller, we didn't get to sit under his teaching like you did. Anything that you would think of that you learned or...
Golly, so much. I mean, it would be hard for me to even pull out what I learned from my brain. It might be easier to tell you the stuff he didn't teach me. He didn't teach me anything about comic books. And so everything in my brain about comic books is not Tim Keller. Everything else, on some level, I credit him because he formed a lot of what I understand about the world and faith. Broadly speaking, I remember going to New York City for college, and quite a lot of people in my church in Oklahoma were very wary of that. There was a certain element of, like, well, you're going to the big city. It's a dark place. And that's true. You should make sure that, you know, you're not going to get lost in a city. At the same time, Keller was never afraid of the city. He never walked in this idea of being afraid of the culture at large. And he didn't feel that if he read the Village Voice, suddenly it would infect his faith in some way. He had a quiet confidence that I very much understood and gravitated toward. He understood that what he had to offer, and specifically, of course, the faith that God had and Jesus has to offer, like, what he had to offer was such a better sale than what the city had to offer. Mm. And I think there wasn't even a question. He walked with that kind of confidence of knowing that, like, the way that, you know, the sort of the most competent fighter walks into a space and knows they can defend themselves. I always felt that he was unafraid of the culture. He was unafraid of the city. He, you know, did such a good job of articulating some of the paradoxes of the faith, both the idea of the law and love at the same time, but also about, you know, Jesus, who was, you know, he wasn't trying to find a muddy middle. He understood that Jesus was more liberal for the liberals and more conservative for the conservatives at the same time, which is a wild and accurate understanding of, of Jesus's approach. You know, I loved the way he carried himself. I've seen, you know, I've met his sons and his family. I love the way he handled himself. I didn't put him in my list of father figures because it would be a parasocial thing. Like, it was a big church. I attended for decades, but you know, I didn't get to sit at his knee and listen personally. And if I had, he would have been, certainly from afar, he absolutely was a father figure to me. So the least we can do is put some respect on his name. He did more for me than, you know, any apologist of any century. And I think history will prove that. So I don't feel like I have to be much of a argumentative type. I think he was great, and greatness is in short supply.
Yeah.
I think as we get older and we've been in ministry a long time, we're looking at how people finish.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of people that have fallen. Some of our friends have fallen. And, you know, as I look at Tim, like, oh, man, he really finished well, too.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
lots of leaders don't finish well.
Mm-mm.
So no, we can add that to it, too. Check. He finished well.
It's not how you start. It's how you finish.
I think, too, as I think about that appeal with the culture and how Tim addressed that, one of the things that I love is I remember I gave my life to Jesus at 16 years old.
Yeah.
And reading the Bible and understanding it for the first time. And I had this, like, are you kidding me? Like, I get it. Like, this is phenomenal. When they said good news, like, this is the best news. It's the best. Like, I want to tell everybody. And my parents, even though they weren't believers at that time, they gave me freedom. My parents created this home of joy. It was like a magnet. We had fun. We had great food. We had meals. It was that atmosphere of family. And so then you combine that with this great good news of knowing Jesus and what he's done and the call in my life. I'd go to these parties in the world and the culture. It felt like nothing.
Right.
Like, this is the dumbest. Like, it just, why are we doing this? And it felt so empty in comparison to God, his word, a family. And I think we get so scared as parents,
sure,
of what our kids are facing and what they'll become and what they'll be under. But I'm just going to remind all of us and as listeners too, like, our faith and our great God is compelling. He woos our kids in. He's drawing us in. And the power of your family together, the meals that you're eating, the laughter that you have around the table, that is great power as well, and it's a magnet. I can see that in you. Like, you love to cook.
That's right.
You love to be around friends. Mm-hmm. It's that Middle Eastern hospitality that draws everybody in. Daniel, this has been fun.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
It's a pleasure.
What a joy to hear Daniel's story over the last 3 days. It's amazing to see how God works in lives in ways that you could never really imagine. In order to shape stories that highlight Christ's goodness and in just incredible ways. It's been such a blessing. I'm Shelby Abbott, and you've been listening to Dave and Ann Wilson with Daniel Neyeri on Family Life Today. He has an incredible story, a true incredible story. And you can read more about it in Daniel's memoir called Everything Sad is Untrue. You can get a copy of his memoir by going online right now to familylifetoday.com, or you can find a link to it in our show notes. Or feel free to give us a call at 800-358-6329 to request your copy. Again, that number is 800, F as in family, L as in life, and then the word today. You know, we're dedicated at Family Life to reaching families all over the country and consequently all over the world. And one of the things we're trying to do during this month is raise $250,000 in new funds by the end of August. We want to do that because we care about marriages and families. And if you want to be a part of that, if you want to be a part of the ministry, be part of the solution to help reach marriages and families all over the world, I'd love it if you you would hop in with us and make a donation. You can do that by simply going to familylifetoday.com to make your donation. And when you do make a donation of any amount, we're going to send you, as a thank you, a limited edition Family Life pen, along with a copy of Brant Hansen's Unoffendable. It's just a small way that we want to say thank you for partnering with us to make this ministry possible by reaching marriages and families all over the world. Again, you can head over to familylifetoday.com to make your donation or give us a call at 800-358-6329. Again, that number is 800, F as in family, L as in life, and then the word today. Or you can drop us a donation in the mail if you'd like. Our address is Family Life, 100 Lakehart Drive, Orlando, Florida, 32832. Now, coming up tomorrow, we have Alan and Jennifer Parr. Alan is a famous YouTuber with over a million subscribers, and they're going to talk about the red flags of unhealthy relationships. It's provocative, so you don't want to miss that tomorrow. On behalf of David Ann Wilson, I'm Shelby Abbott. We'll see you back next time for another edition of Family Life Today. Family Life Today is a donor-supported production of Family Life, a crew ministry, helping you pursue the relationships that matter most.